It's Wednesday, September 13th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, evidence that a fake news button on Facebook might not have that effect we would want it to. We're also going to talk about the ethics of undercover reporting after an Indian journalist is brought up on charges for not identifying herself as a reporter to a soldier who committed suicide after her story went to press. And the next generation of Mouseketeers. We'll talk about Disney's newest plan for the Mickey Mouse Club. There's hopefully a lot more that we'll get to before our half hours start, but let's start with another week consumed with hurricane coverage. I don't know about the two of you, but I had the Weather Channel on my TV probably for about 3 days straight, even sleeping with it on. That again, we talked about this a few weeks ago, provided some of the most comprehensive and contextual coverage of almost anything out there.
Yeah, I mean, the Weather Channel, again, did what it's known for, it's been known for ever since its inception, is covering these massive weather events, whether you're talking about Hurricane Harvey, whether you're talking about Irma, whether you're talking about snowstorms, which we sometimes have to deal with here. I mean, they did a very good job of covering that, especially as the storm went through the Caribbean and was headed toward Florida. They were there to try to determine which way was it going to go. Was it going to go up the east coast of Florida, up the west coast? And they had people positioned in the right places. So I do have to commend them for that.
Yeah, I didn't follow the Weather Channel and the networks as much during Harvey as I did during Irma, partly because I had family in Houston, and so the local media had more of a resonance with me. But I do think that the local media this time also seemed to do a good job, and that only stands to reason. I mean, these folks, you hope, the reporters and editors, they're part of that community. They're living there. They're experiencing it the same way the residents do. So, again, kudos to the Florida media, too.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about Florida media in a minute. I want to talk, though, about a story that ran in the New York Times that had people both in our journalism classes here, discussions I've seen among journalists and non-journalists alike, a piece that ran in the New York Times pretty much saying, why is it that we have journalists and reporters who are saying, stay inside, shelter in place, remain safe, yet we keep sending them out to go stand in it? And this has been, you know, since 1961, when Dan Rather first did it in Houston during the
Hurricane Carla.
Thank you. I was trying to remember the name. I had it in my notes and didn't remember. Is it time for that to stop?
I think there's probably this is a more difficult question to answer than it sounds like on the surface. Sure, from one sense, reporters shouldn't be out there, you know, threatening their lives by being blown about by the wind. But, you know, people watch television news for a reason. They want to see what's happening. It adds a level of authenticity that you don't get otherwise. And also, there are differences in how well reporters prepare and follow the rules. There are news organizations that chase after storms that have them come to their community frequently that have detailed plans. And as long as their staff is following those plans, they're in less jeopardy than the anchors or reporters who parachute in and haven't done this before.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I watched a lot of the coverage, both of Harvey, of course, because I have family in the area, but even of Irma. And having covered hurricanes as a reporter, as a newspaper reporter, who was usually around television reporters when these things were going on, I'd always ask them the question, why are you out there putting yourself in danger? And many of them would say, well, I really want to get the story. And then I've also had some who say, well, my boss says I got to be there. We got to be on air. So you've got both of those things going on at the same time. And I myself was worried for friends who are out there having to cover those storms and be in live trucks and in those situations, I'm worried about their safety oftentimes.
And it's interesting you say that. And I think I've talked about this on this program in the past. I worked for a news director who once told me that she never cared what I put my morning live reporter on. People weren't paying attention to what that reporter was actually talking about or reporting on. That especially on a morning show, what they were really looking at was what was the reporter wearing? Were they holding an umbrella? That television news becomes the window to the outside for people. And by putting the reporter out there, even in these potentially unsafe situations, it provides dare I say, some context to just how strong is that wind that's blowing? Just how hard is that rain that's coming down? So it really is, Mike, when you say a complicated question to answer, you can see both sides of that.
Well, and in fact, I would give kudos. I think it was Jim Cantore on the Weather Channel, if I'm not mistaken, who actually did a bit of transparency, and he and his crew showed you, here's where we positioned ourselves under this really thick concrete awning at this place away from the seawall, and then we're out here, so we have a base of safety. And so there is a bit of a, I think, and it's responsible journalists are going to do that. They're going to tell you how they're making sure that they're not just out there for ratings, but they are trying to take
care of themselves. Yeah, but you know, my fear, and this came out in one of the stories that we have on our Links blog, where you had really young reporters who are out there first time covering these kinds of events and finding themselves in situations that probably aren't safe. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to what you were talking about, Mike, that you have procedures and policies in place, but procedures and policies can't protect when you don't know what's going to happen. And oftentimes in these storms, you don't know what's going to happen from moment to moment. And my fear is that someone's going to be live on camera, and either a tree is going to fall on them, or a piece of glass is going to come across.
Or a street sign is going to dislodge.
Yes, and it is going to be an ugly scene. And that is the one thing that worries me about a lot of this coverage that I see.
There was one reference, though, in that article from the New York Times, mm-hmm. which suggested that maybe we didn't need to have reporters standing out there on television anymore because of social media. And I was trying to figure, you mean because there's more content from citizens who are contributing to show what the hurricane is really like? Do we want to be encouraging them to go out there and be even less safe than our own trained journalists?
Well, as we talk about the coverage, there's one thing we should mention, and in some ways accept responsibility when we on our own program fall down a little bit. We received a little bit of criticism last week from Christopher Saunders, who's a former master's student of ours who works as a journalist in the Bahamas. And he mentioned on our Facebook page, how could you spend all of this time talking about the hurricane and not mention what had been going on in the Caribbean, not mention what happened to St. Thomas, what was about to happen in the Bahamas, in Cuba? And he raises a really interesting point, and we played a party to that on this program. Ernest, you get a free pass on this since you weren't here last week. We played into that narrative just as much, where it became so Florida-centric that we had forgotten about some of the other areas, including U.S. territories, that were heavily affected.
No, I think that's a valid criticism, and people in the news, people like us, are just as guilty sometimes of homerism or nationalism as anybody else. I will say, if you watched last night with the big telethon to raise money for the victims, a few of the celebrities mentioned the Caribbean a couple of times, but none of the examples of the videos and the stories of mothers and children or first responders was from the Caribbean. It was all from Texas.
Well, I can tell you now, I wasn't here last week. I was in Florida last week as the storm was approaching. Yeah. And the local news, the local television news, and I was in Tallahassee, the local television news talked extensively about what was going on in the Caribbean as that storm was coming.
They also have proximity to that region, too, that we don't necessarily have.
But then when you switch over, then when I switched over to national news, it was all about what's going to happen to Florida, what's going to happen to the Gulf, what's going to happen to the East Coast of Florida, and that sort of thing. And so you could see the differences. I mean, see the stark differences in the way that the national media was covering it and the way the local media was covering it in Florida.
Well, maybe it's because we feel like we're running out of storylines, but it seems there have been a lot more stories and more coverage coming out about how the newsrooms are reacting to this as well and covering the story when they have to evacuate their own newsrooms. Where do they go? How does the news get out there? We have a couple of examples of those that are on our Links blog. And a few minutes ago, I mentioned that some of us here in Mid-Missouri, we were going to talk more about that, that how some of us in Mid-Missouri played a role in the coverage. KBIA was host to a journalist from our sister station, WLRN, in Miami. And you may have seen a version of the big project that we helped them with. It's an interactive map that plotted posts from Facebook and Twitter and Instagram from across the state, showing the storm surge, damage, rescue efforts, and the like. That map was the work primarily of digital content director Nathan Lawrence, and, well, me. He built the infrastructure. I led a team of students that spent a significant amount of time on Sunday and Monday and then yesterday doing social listening and verification, finding some of those points and plotting them out. We had other students who were doing taking in feeds from reporters and from first responders and from emergency management officials and doing rewrites. What this shows, though, is how we can really rethink how we cover natural disasters, that maybe you don't necessarily need to be in the eye of the storm in order to do that.
No, I think, in fact, having a little bit of distance might allow you to cover certain aspects of the mm-hmm. storm differently. I also think this goes beyond another way of covering disasters. I think it's a reflection of how more and more news organizations are partnering to cover all kinds of stories, partly out of economic necessity, but the work that's being produced, I think, is better for it.
Well, I think it's economic necessity, but I think it's also has much to do with the fact that a lot of these news organizations are now owned by the same company, so they're pooling their resources in order to do that. So if you say if you have a station that's in the eye of a catastrophe and has to relocate, they're relocating to another sister station or they're partnering with somebody else to be able to provide that information and get it out there. So I mean there are various ways in which to make that
happen.
Well,
and I will tell you, when I was speaking to the WLRN staff member and she heard that I had the same level of training and experience in social media verification that she had, that our training came from the same place, and that I knew how to use their web CMS, the content management system that builds their website, she knew she had another faculty editor level hand who could help her work with students. And that is helpful. It's exactly what you described.
By the way, can we say just a word more about verification
skills?
Please
do. Please do.
Because, I mean, your team was among the first to find out that one of the videos that was being shared by no less than the White House social media mm-hmm. director was fake video. I mean, it was video from another event,
it
not
was some
from
dark
the Miami
video,
airport.
But it was not from the Miami airport. And we determined that with the help as well from First Draft News.
And it makes me wonder to what extent, I mean, I don't know if the White House social media director cares or not, but people need to be trained to be able to do this kind of verification when we're relying more on social media for our news coverage.
And I mean, when you're talking about things, you're talking about life and death situations, mm-hmm. you want to be able to provide news and information that is accurate. And I think the whole concept of someone putting something out that they haven't verified that then winds up being fake, but you know, you're spending a whole lot of time trying to deal with that when you should be dealing with providing that the accurate news and information that people need.
Well, and the timing on this couldn't be any better. A study from Yale University looked at fake news. And for how long have we been saying how much we'd love if there was some kind of a disputed button or a fake news button to flag people to some of the poop that's floating around out there? Well, it looks like the Yaleys have found that that might not matter. What did they find in this study exactly? Let's get into some of the detail.
Well, so they interviewed about 7,500 people through a survey online, and they basically showed half of the group some headlines, and mm-hmm. half of those headlines were real and half were fake. And then the other group, they showed the same thing, but they tagged some of the fake news headlines to see if the tagging, along the lines of what Facebook has been doing, would make any difference. And their study found that, well, it really didn't. There was a modest increase in the percentage of people who could identified a story as fake when it was tagged on Facebook, but there were quite a few that didn't. And in fact, some younger people were more inclined to think that a fake story was true if it wasn't tagged. A pretty mixed bag of results.
You know, there are two things about this that really jumps out at me. Number mm-hmm. one is when you read through the article that's on our links blog, Facebook is basically trying to defend what it's doing more so than trying to really deal with the fact that their verification system may have some issues with it. And in terms of what's fake and what's not, what's tagged and what's not. The second issue that I have is that, I mean, or what this points to is there needs to be a comprehensive look at media literacy, and I'm talking about from grade school all the way up to college, because I think that's part of the problem here is that, especially when you talk about that age group, they're not recognizing mm-hmm. that many of these stories have not just inaccuracies, but they're made up. I mean, they're just fake, and that, to me, speaks to the larger issue of a lack of education when it comes to what is an accurate source of information and what's not.
You know, I'll agree with your larger point, but I think that Facebook, to a certain extent, defended itself appropriately because the researchers at Yale did not talk to Facebook members necessarily. I mean, lots of people use Facebook, mm-hmm. but they didn't sample within Facebook to see if Facebook's tagging really made any difference. Facebook makes the case that when they tag something, they also, in their algorithm, push those stories down further so they don't get shared as much. And they also pointed out the fact that, you know, when Facebook also links to the full story from the fact checkers, something the researchers didn't do. So it's not a totally equivalent situation. On the other hand, you might be more sympathetic with Facebook if they'd release some of their own data right. so that we'd have an idea of what's going on behind their walls.
Okay, well, you know what we haven't had much of on this show lately? Screaming talking heads going after each other to the point where you can't hear or understand what anyone's saying. No, really, last week when we heard that Sarah Huckabee Sanders and her father, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, were going to be guests on The View, a lot of people were excited to see and hear what the panel would ask the famous father and daughter. And a conversation that started out pretty mainstream got heated. And like any good dad, Huckabee made sure everyone knew he thought his daughter was treated unfairly.
Is the media supposed to not report on the fact that 95% of what he says is a lie?
That is you are doing exactly what we're talking about and pushing a false narrative.
No, it's not.
95% of what the president says is not a lie.
I feel sorry for you that you have to go out and defend those lies every day.
Give me a break. 95% of what the president says is a lie. I mean, really?
It was absurd. But, you know, I have to believe that there are a lot of smarter people in the American public than they think there is. And the fact is that, again, their hatred of Donald Trump is so irrational that I think that comes across. But it's just amazing to me to think that they believe that they're representing. If it's a shock to you, I actually like Whoopi and I get along with Joy. I have a nice communication with them during
the
breaks.
Yeah, I like them too. Yeah.
So what? You know, so we have a country where we can express strong opinions. I just think it's important that we at least engage those conversations.
The women of The View weren't having it.
When you're a right-wing talking head, and I was one, I worked for Fox News, I came from there. What you're trained to do, really, is to go into what's referred to as, you know, the liberal cesspool or the, you know, the lion's den, and you go in there and you defend your point, and then you go back to the friendly zone and you say, oh, you know, they're out of touch with America. That doesn't work here, Mike, because I am a conservative and I didn't vote for Trump, and I am standing for conservative principles. You don't get to say you came here and the liberal media opposed you. No, I sat right here, and it's not irrational that I opposed Donald Trump. Donald Trump's character was questionable. Donald Trump has gone on Twitter rants that have insulted foreign policy leaders, that have insulted people in the intelligence community, that have insulted media figures. Donald Trump is voting to raise a debt ceiling that when President Obama did that, you all Republicans out there had a problem with.
Why would that be the training?
Because you know what? Cable news has a lack of independent thinkers, and everyone's interested in playing to the base, and everyone's interested in this is our viewership, and this is our president, because he's the Republican, and our network is built on this Republican brand. You know what? No more. No more. There are people out here that stand for principles, and I am one of them,
right.
And these women here are one of them, and you don't get to pull us in media, whatever.
Irrationality.
Okay, Jedediah Beeler there, calling it exactly what it was. She opened the playbook and described what Mike Huckabee did on Fox News, literally word for word in his exact action.
Well, you know, she pretty much called him out. And she took it away from the straight liberal conservative to say, hey, they're playing to their base. When they go on the air, these are the talking points. These are the things they're going to say that play to their base. And I think what she was trying to say was whether you're talking about Fox or whether you're talking about MSNBC, this is what they do. So, I mean, you know, sort of pulled the curtain back and here you go.
So I could say that almost every person you showed on the screen there had something valid to say. And I can also say that almost everyone that you had on the screen there also was grossly oversimplifying the situation. So I think that she described what goes on behind the scenes of Fox News pretty well. I think Mike Huckabee was describing how the media work and the fact that there is
absolutely
there's certainly a lot of hatred towards Trump on the part of some folks that work for The View. No, it is not true that 95% of everything that President Trump says is false, but PolitiFact did find that on the statements that they assessed for their stories about public policy, that 95% of them could be ranked as false. So there's just an awful lot needs to be unpacked, and on a talk show like that, that's not how you're going
to
unpack it.
And not just that talk show, almost any talk show. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you get the talking heads together, regardless of what station you're looking at, you're going to have this sort of back and forth, and the information, the accurate information, sort of gets lost in the yelling and the screaming for everybody trying to get their point across. So
this program is taped middle of the day on Wednesdays. So this morning, by the time we've taped this, Hillary Clinton has already been on the Today Show today. She's been on The View. This evening, she's going to be on Live with Anderson Cooper. You think she's going to face some of that same type? We've seen some of the interviews already, but the same type of questioning, and at the same time, some of the same type of criticism on the back end that Sarah Huckabee Sanders did.
Yes. They're going to be in some of those interviews, probably all those interviews, they're going to be people trying to get her to talk about what is it in this book or what's not in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, we've read the book. We've read the excerpts. What's not in the book? Who do you really blame for losing the election? You know, and it's that sort of trying to get that gotcha moment. That's what happens on the talking head shows. I mean, that's just what happens.
I think the cable news anchors will do that, but I think they will do it with some level of respect, as is befitting a public person. The people on The View, for the most part, love Hillary Clinton. They'll ask tough questions, but they won't do it in the way that they did with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, basically calling her boss a liar and feeling sorry for her because she had to defend such a liar.
I agree with you on that part, Mark.
Okay, let's change focus a little bit and talk for a few minutes about a story that's been developing in India over the course of the last few weeks, which has brought the ethics of undercover reporting back into the forefront. A journalist there faces criminal charges after a soldier who she interviewed without his knowledge committed suicide earlier this year. She didn't identify herself to the soldier that she was a journalist or make it clear that there was a hidden camera recording their conversation. The video ran on the online-only news site, The Quint, which had his image blurred, but the Indian Army is now claiming that her actions are squarely responsible for his death. What was the content of this report exactly?
Well, I mean, the content they were basically trying to, in this reporting, yeah, trying to get at there's a level of officers within the Indian Army that pretty much take care of the upper officers so they can pay more attention to military operations. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem with that is they were asked to do things by these officers that they shouldn't have been, like walking their dog, taking their wives to the beauty parlor.
Not military related activities,
right? And so they felt that the only way they could get the story was to send someone in undercover to talk to these people. And when this came out, one of the officers who was a part of this committed suicide. And the government is claiming that the reporters were responsible for this officer's basically committing suicide. So they were brought up on charges.
You know, go ahead.
I was going to say, what were the reasons she felt she needed to go undercover, that she couldn't tell the story without identifying herself?
I don't think that they explained that very fully. I mean, in fact, there was a video on social media, mm-hmm, from one of these sort of servant officers was complaining about it. So it wasn't like there was no documentation of video form there. They didn't say that they'd made any other attempts to interview people. This person that they did have on camera, even though they blurred them, some people say that he was still identifiable, right, by the context. And he was a victim, not a perpetrator, right, of wrongdoing. So there's lots of reasons why I wouldn't have gone in and done it the way they did.
Well, I mean, and I was looking at it the same way. I mean, the more I read the story, the more I kept going, like, well, why did you feel the need to go undercover? It just didn't seem like the something that was necessary in order to get public attention, which is one of the criteria, mm-hmm, for doing that. I mean, it's to expose this. But I think they could have done it without all the subterfuge that they went through.
Having said all of that, I'm surprised that the government charged them with violating essentially India's Secrecies Act. And I wonder whether they'll be convicted for that. I have to say, whether they are or they are not, I'm sure that reporter and the staff, I hope, that they are taking a very serious lesson from this. They can't control what somebody's going to do as a result of this, but to say they had nothing to do with that young man's suicide, I think would also be false.
But I also think that the Indian military and government officials are doing this to send a message to others about whether or not if you're thinking about doing this, you better rethink your plan.
Okay, well, this one's kind of interesting. As the investigation into possible Russian influence in the Trump campaign and last year's election continues, the Justice Department has asked people associated with RT to register as foreign agents. RT, of course, being the Kremlin-controlled news organization that produces English-language news, has a large presence in Washington. This is a law that goes back to pre-World War II, 1938, this was put into effect.
Yeah, exactly. And this I'm really surprised about because, you know, you've got our government that's going after RT. But there's an even larger story here because now you've got Germany that's doing the same thing. You've got the European Union that's going after RT because what they're basically saying is that what RT is doing is in its media, in its coverage, in the way in which it exposes so-called stories, that it is playing along with the Russians and not necessarily working on behalf of free flow of news and information.
There's a whole lot about this story, too, that's below the surface. I mean, we don't know why the Justice Department was interviewing these folks and suggesting they need to register, who exactly they were talking to. Was it part of Mueller's investigation or some other investigation? Mm-hmm. We don't know if they were all American employees or if there were Russians who were. There's a lot we don't know about this, but we do know this much. RT and Sputnik, these two Russian media outlets, they are controlled by the government, by the Kremlin. There's no question about that. And they do put out propaganda on behalf of Russia.
Yeah.
Okay, well, before we go,
M-I-T. See you real soon.
K-E-Y.
Why? Because we like you.
M-O-U-S-E.
No, that's not our new close music. It's a segue that our audience, myself included, might be able to connect with a little better than, well, this. So that's part of the music video that's part of the new Mickey Mouse Club. It's actually called Club Mickey Mouse, so we're going to flip that one on its head. And instead of a show that was always done on television, this one is going to be on Facebook and Instagram only. So it's going to be a show that's meant to be consumed on social media. The part that's really confusing to me about this, though, is that think about that Disney audience, and you have to be 13 years old to get a Facebook or an Instagram account. So who are they trying to target here?
Parents. I mean, I'll just, for example, my parents, they never tried to make me watch the Mickey Mouse Club as a kid. I watched the Disney Channel a lot with my kids, and I'm sure parents had quite a bit to do with that. This is a natural progression onto social media, and the parents of these young kids are social media fanatics. That's who it's targeted at, I think, to get them involved in deciding their children should pay attention.
Well, I think Mike is right, but what concerns me about this is the authenticity. And it lacks, at least the little part that I've seen and I've read.
You mean
lacks,
that looks really cheesy?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was really cheesy. And
Mickey Mouse Club was cheesy.
Yeah, yes.
Disney Channel
program was cheesy. Yes, it was. But I mean,
it was also in a different time.
But we're in a different age. And it really bothers me that something like this is going out there because I don't think it's going to resonate with a certain segment of the audience.
We'll see how long it lasts. That music means we're out of time for this week. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more on each of our topics on the Links blog at kbia.org. We also invite you to like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.